Coming up, the Gulen movement, named for an influential Turkish imam now living in Pennsylvania, who urges his followers to build schools instead of mosques. Also, after the shootings in Tucson, the political realities facing anyone wanting to put limits on guns. And James Wolfensohn, the former president of the World Bank, on the importance of religious groups in international development.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're your retirement company, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Welcome, I'm Bob Abernethy. It's good to have you with us. President Obama welcomed Chinese President Hu Jintao to Washington this week as several advocacy groups pushed the president to confront the Chinese leader on human rights and religious freedom violations. Protesters calling for a free Tibet also gathered in front of the White House.
For China and the U.S. to work together as business equals, that's great. We are not against that at all. We just don't agree that it should come at the expense of human rights, whether it's people inside China or in Tibet.
Obama urged China to open a dialogue with the Dalai Lama. He called universal rights essential to a nation's success and prosperity. President Hu admitted more needs to be done in China on human rights, but some rights groups remain skeptical, saying real action must follow Hu's words. The House of Representatives voted this week to repeal the health care reform law, although that repeal has no chance of passing the Senate, which is controlled by Democrats. Religious groups who lobbied heavily both for and against the law remain deeply divided over the legislation. Several liberal groups urged Congress to keep the legislation intact. Some conservative groups called for its repeal, saying the law allows federal funding of abortion. In Iraq, Shiite pilgrims were targeted in another wave of deadly violence this week. At least 50 people were killed and nearly 200 others wounded when car bombs exploded at security checkpoints around the holy city of Karbala. Every year, hundreds of thousands of Shiite pilgrims visit Karbala, which is an important site in the centuries-old split between Sunnis and Shiites. In predominantly Christian southern Sudan, the official results are not in yet from last week's vote on whether to secede from the Muslim North, but a preliminary count shows almost 99% voted for independence. The official results are expected in early February. In this country, the imam at the center of the controversy over a proposed Islamic center near Ground Zero will no longer be front and center. Imam Faisal Abdul Rauf and his wife, Daisy Khan, have been prominent spokespersons for the so-called Park 51 project. They said it would oppose extremism and promote interfaith dialogue, but other organizers said they wanted a greater focus on the local Muslim community. So while Rauf remains on the board, others will take over direction of the project, which is still in the fundraising stage. This past week in Congress, Democratic Congresswoman Carolyn McCarthy of New York introduced a bill that would ban the sale of all gun magazines that can hold more than 10 bullets. The clip used in the Tucson shootings held 30. But as the popularity of gun shows suggests, any attempt to tighten gun laws faces strong opposition. One man who understands the politics of gun legislation is Paul Helmke, president of the Brady Campaign Against Gun Violence. He's a Republican and was 3 times elected mayor of Fort Wayne, Indiana. Welcome to you.
Thanks, Bob.
So what are the realities on this? A bill has gone into the House, another one's going into the Senate next week, but realistically, does either one of them have any chance?
I believe they do. I think this time it could be a different response.
Why?
For a number of reasons. It was a member of Congress that was attacked, that's one. Secondly, the bill that we're talking about relates directly to the Tucson shooting. The individual was stopped not because the police responded or someone else with a gun responded. He was stopped because the clip ran out of bullets. If he had run out of bullets after 10 instead of 30, less people are injured. And the other thing is, this showed how weak the laws in the books are. No law was broken. Even with his dangerousness to his fellow students, no law was broken until he pulled the trigger the first time. So I think this time they might treat this not as a Second Amendment wedge issue. They might treat this as a public safety issue. And just as they banned cop killer bullets and plastic guns that don't show up in metal detectors, maybe they'll say these high-capacity clips should also be banned.
But isn't it the case that the overwhelming majority of the American people, who the people in Congress are supposed to represent, feel that any restriction on gun ownership is wrong?
And that's not true. Actually, the one poll that sometimes is used to say support for gun control is dropping say that now only 46 or 50% support stronger measures as opposed to 75% 15, 20 years ago. But that's still showing that a number of people support in general gun control. And when you ask about specific measures, even licensing people to have guns like we license drivers, 66% support. Background checks on all sales, restrictions on semi-automatic weapons, those things have strong support when you ask the individual question.
When you ask the individual, and how about the McCarthy bill? Is
that McCarthy bill, we've polled it three different times, 58% support it, 50% of the American people strongly support it. It's hard to find that kind of intensity for any kind of a question.
Mm-hmm. This past week, there was the announcement of a coalition of something like 24 religious groups to support some kind of gun.
Faiths United to Prevent Gun Violence was announced this last week on Martin Luther King Day. The next day, they were part of the news conference supporting Carolyn McCarthy's bill. And I think this is important. This is part of what's going to change the dynamic. We need leadership from the top, from the president, speaking on this. But more importantly, we need our people in the communities telling their elected officials, do something about gun violence. And the faith community plays such an important role in raising the moral issue, raising that issue with their congregations, and getting people to speak up.
After the Tucson shootings, there was some comment about gun control from some people in the religious community, but there was an awful lot of silence too. Did that disappoint you?
Silence from anybody is disappointing. And I think, you know, some people, it's always wait till folks are out of the hospital, wait till the funerals are over. But I keep telling people, this is an issue I talk about every day. I say the same thing every day. And we need more people saying the same thing. To allow 30,000 people to be killed by guns every year in this country, another 70,000 to be injured by guns every year in this country, to have this almost worship of guns that occurs and the violence that flows from that is something we shouldn't be tolerating in our society.
But for you personally, is this a religious issue?
It does fit into my religious tradition. I went to a Lutheran grade school growing up. We talked about nonviolence. The story of the Garden of Gethsemane is put down that sword, is what Jesus is telling the disciple. That's the lesson we need to learn. And it really gets into how do we relate to our fellow man? Do we live in a state of fear of everyone we're dealing with, or do we feel that we're a community of faith and that you respect the other, that you deal with the other, or do we bring a gun to every confrontation?
But isn't it the case that there are a lot of religious people who very much like guns, too?
And I'm not anti-gun. I'm not against the gun. But what the gun does to so many people, and making that gun so easily available to dangerous people, like the Tucson shooter, irresponsible people, we all sin and fall short of the glory of God. We need to restrict the easy access to this. Again, even Carolyn McCarthy's bill isn't talking about the gun, it's talking about the high-capacity ammunition that's not used to hunt, not used for personal protection, only used to kill a lot of people quickly.
Paul Helmke, president of the Brady Campaign Against Gun Violence. Honey, thanks. Now, a story on the Gulen movement, named for an influential Turkish imam, Fethullah Gulen, now living in Pennsylvania. He preaches that Muslims should embrace modernity, and those he has inspired have created more than 1,000 schools in 100 countries. Lucky Severson reports.
His name is Fethullah Gulen. He is a 69-year-old Turkish Islamic scholar and author, apparently in poor health, who came to the U.S. seeking medical treatment. He lives a secluded life at a retreat in Pennsylvania. So why was he voted by his admirers in a survey by Foreign Policy magazine as the most significant intellectual in the world? Among those admirers are Kemal Aksu's and Alp Aslandawan.
Kind, modest, humble, generous. We see him as a source of information, inspiration, but never profit. He will be the one who will be troubled the most if he hears that followers or inspirers see him kind of prophet.
Personally, he is definitely very knowledgeable, very sincere in wanting the best for the people, not just Turkey, but for all humanity.
Gulen has inspired his followers to build schools, provide humanitarian aid, and engage in interfaith dialogue. University of Houston professor Helen Ebaugh, who wrote a book on the Gulen movement, says the movement got its start when Gulen was an imam in Turkey.
When Fethullah Gulen began preaching in the late 60s and early 70s in Turkey, his message was, we don't need more madrasas. We need schools that will promote science and math and secular subjects. And his contention was that one can be modern and one can be scientific and still be a good Muslim.
Bill Martin is a senior fellow in religion and public policy at the James Baker Institute at Rice University. He says the Gulen movement is different from fundamentalist Islam because they respect all faiths and believe religion is compatible with science.
I think it's fair to say that Islam has had difficulty in coming to terms with modernity. And in that, I think that the Gulen movement offers a much more positive picture of what Islam can be.
Gulen-inspired volunteers from Turkey bring Turkish language and culture with them. In Houston, they sponsor a Turkish Olympiad where American students compete in Turkish dance and song. The winners compete in an annual competition in Ankara, Turkey. There are more than 1,000 Gulen-inspired schools and universities in over 100 countries.
Gulen has always emphasized education, and that really lies at the core of this movement. To be a good Muslim meant to be well-educated, and to be a good Muslim who participated in modernity meant to be conversant and well-educated in science, math, and technology.
Education helps you overcome ignorance, poverty, corruption, hate, extremism, racism, whatever, all the illnesses of the society. Because of that, education is very important.
I need another number, a big number.
In Texas, there are 33 nationally recognized public charter schools with over 16,000 students, grades K through 12. They're called Harmony Schools, and the Turkish superintendent insists they are strictly secular and in no way connected to Gulen. Professor Ebaugh says there's a reason for this kind of sensitivity.
I think a lot of that is related to the Islamophobia that exists in this country. I think there's a lot of fear, that Islam is trying to take hold of this country and countries around the world, that it's trying to spread itself.
About 60% of the kids in the Texas Harmony schools come from disadvantaged neighborhoods. The schools say they have a 100% graduation rate. No wonder there are 21,000 kids on the waiting list.
I think the Harmony schools are an outstanding example of what the Gulen followers have been able to accomplish, and particularly with respect to education. Of the three high schools that had graduating seniors this year, only three students had not already been admitted to a four-year college by the time of graduation.
I know teachers who stay up here for 7 o'clock at night, 8 o'clock at night, who are also working at night from home.
They know our expectations for them. Through kindergarten all the way to the high school, they know, hey, this is a college school. This is our goal is to get you into college.
I have never worked harder, but you really see the results because the parents are very involved. The kids really respond.
Gulen, not only he urges teachers to go and work at these schools. On the other hand, he urges people from all walks of life to go and support all these schools. Build up schools instead of mosques. Build up universities instead of mosques. Build up cultural centers, interfaith organizations, aid organizations, hospitals instead of mosques.
Supporters say Gulen owns nothing himself, but has persuaded others to give generously to many independent organizations.
The movement has become quite wealthy. It's one of the richest movements in Turkey. It has private hospitals, it has all these private schools. There's a big media industry, one of the biggest in Turkey. It has Aman newspaper. Kimsi Yakmu is one of the latest. That's their relief organization. They help disaster victims all over the world.
Kimsi Yakmu, and in the U.S., Helping Hands, contribute millions of dollars in humanitarian aid each year. Professor Iba says in Turkey, Gulen urged businessmen to grow their businesses and give a part of their earnings, as much as a third, to support humanitarian aid and education.
The movement is financed not only by these wealthy businessmen, but more importantly, it's financed by everybody in the movement. Everybody contributes. And the average seems to be about 10%.
I go beyond the expected level in my income level. And for all of this, my motivation is that just like God loves us as human beings, we also should act in a manner that is pleasing to God. And I believe that all of these actions, charitable donations, volunteerism, are pleasing to God. That is why I'm doing all of this.
ALP is a volunteer in charge of the Institute for Interfaith Dialogue in Houston, which is located in the Raindrop Turkish House. This is a mock-up of the projected interfaith center, which will include a Jewish synagogue, a mosque, and a Christian church. Gulen has always stressed the importance of interfaith dialogue to promote peace, and has met with Pope John Paul II and reached out to leaders of many religious minorities. And he may have been the first Muslim leader to condemn the 9/11 terrorist attacks.
He immediately posted an ad, clearly saying that this is an non-Islamic act. It is not even a human act. You know, those people who committed this, not Muslim, they cannot even be called humans. He said Bin Laden is a monster, and people around him are monsters if they think like him.
Alp Eslandowan says Gulen teaches that suicide attacks cannot be justified in Islam.
Some people try to justify the killings, homicidal killings, by saying that those people who are engaged in those, they don't have any other means. And he said that this is not a Muslim's view. It cannot be a Muslim's thinking. Because for a Muslim, if the end goal is virtuous, worthwhile, holy, then the mechanism, then the means should also be holy.
Professor Iba says the movement could do better by placing women in leadership roles. Gulen is not without his critics.
The big issue in Turkey for the critics is a fear that the movement is becoming very powerful, very wealthy, and that there's a sub rosa agenda to create an Islamic State, and they always compare it to Khomeini and Iran.
I think there's no warrant to the charges that Gulen wants to take over and impose Sharia law. I think that, frankly, is an absurd fear.
The movement is neither sect or cult. It is a civil society movement.
Sometimes they are accused of being a missionizing entity. And as far as I know, I don't know of anyone, through the schools or otherwise, that they have tried to turn into a Muslim.
For the time being, those who follow Gulen, both critics and admirers, seem to agree that he is leading one of the most important movements in Islam. For Religion and Ethics News Weekly, I'm Lucky Severson in Houston.
We have a conversation today with investment banker James Wolfensohn, who was president of the World Bank from 1995 to 2005. During those years, he opened an unprecedented dialogue with religious groups. Wolfensohn was born in Australia, but is now a U.S. citizen. He's written his autobiography called A Global Life. Kim Lawton spoke with him.
During his decade as president of the World Bank, James Wolfensohn was a force to be reckoned with. And whether he was being praised for pushing new efforts to help the world's poor, or people were protesting against him for not doing enough, Wolfensohn sparked an unprecedented international conversation about poverty and development. I asked him if he believes the United States has a moral obligation to help poorer countries.
Personally, I believe so. And it is the stated intention of just about every president to make a contribution on the field of poverty and on the field of development. And I think they make the assumption that the nation agrees with that.
Promoting international development is not only the right thing to do, he says, but the practical one as well.
I regard it as a moral responsibility. I think also, though, in terms of peace and security on our planet, it's important to have economic development, because countries that are moving forward economically, by and large, don't attack other countries.
But with a relentless recession and high unemployment rates, Wolfensohn acknowledges it can be difficult to convince Americans that they should still send aid to other countries.
And at a time like that, it's not surprising that we tend to look inwards to try and see how we can do something that can solve our own problems. But what you can't do is just forget outside the country to deal with that.
During his tenure at the World Bank, Wolfensohn raised eyebrows by developing a new dialogue between his very secular institution and top leaders of the international religious community.
A very substantial part of aid to people in poverty goes through religious organizations. And so it occurred to me that if we could get a dialogue between the people that were interested in development and religious leaders, we might have the basis for far greater cooperation and far greater understanding.
Was that a hard sell within the World Bank itself, within that culture?
I think they all thought I was mad, to be quite honest. I won't say all, but I don't think I had a lot of support. But one of the great things about the World Bank is that if you're president of it, you have quite a lot of discretion on what you do. And I would have to say that personally, I found it amongst the most important initiatives that I took. Very little talked about, by the way.
On three separate occasions, Wolfensohn and other bank officials met with religious leaders across the spectrum to discuss how they could work together to address global poverty.
And it was sort of fun for me as a nice Jewish boy from Australia bringing together all these great religious leaders.
Wolfensohn says he believes the meetings accomplished a lot.
Once we got them talking, as you know better than I, they don't always share secrets with each other about what they're doing, because in a sense there is a competitive element amongst religious leaders. But when you get to the question of humanity and the question of poverty, I found that the competitive element disappeared, and we were able to talk about these fundamental humanitarian issues on a very even basis.
The meetings planted seeds for religious activism that continues, such as a massive interfaith march in support of the UN's Millennium Development Goals to alleviate poverty. Wolfensohn believes such efforts must continue.
The most broadly based access to the developing world is through religious people. There are more of them out there. They've been there longer. They know the countries. They're installed locally. They don't all sit in a big office in the headquarters. They're out in the field. And so it is a tragedy if they're not embraced, in my opinion, in the overall development process.
Wolfensohn is still active in international development issues. One of his priority projects is an initiative helping train young Arabs to get jobs. He says he's also concerned that young Americans be prepared for a globalized future.
We have to really revamp our education system, not just in maths and science, which I think we should, but in terms of humanities and in terms of where our kids are going in the world, and we're just not training them.
The world is getting smaller, he says, and America can't afford to ignore that. I'm Kim Lawton in Washington.
On our calendar this week, it's New Year's for Tibetan Buddhists. The holiday Losar begins on Wednesday. Celebrations include traditional dancing and other ceremonies. Finally, thousands of Orthodox Christians gathered on both sides of the Jordan River this week to celebrate Epiphany, when they commemorate the baptism of Jesus. The Jordanian side of the river has long been an official heritage center, but on the Israeli-controlled West Bank side, pilgrims had to coordinate their visits with the military. Israeli officials are planning to open a new tourism center on their side as well. But there may be a problem. Activists say the site is still littered with landmines. The Israeli military says it's been working to clear away mines. The pilgrimage area, they say, will be a completely mine-free zone. That's our program for now. I'm Bob Abernethy. We want to hear from you. You can comment on all of our stories on our website and share them. Audio and video podcasts are also available. You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter, find us on YouTube, and watch us anytime, anywhere, on smartphones and iPhones with our mobile web app. Join us at pbs.org. As we leave you, more from the Turkish Olympiad in Houston.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're your retirement company. And the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.